This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of the first installment of Show and Tell, Paul Lucas's monthly open mic night. The event took place on March 15th, 2012.
Eric Cabinet, and I want to thank Sina Najafi in the back for taking on this series, which for the past little over a year had been at the City Reliquary in Williamsburg, and where Show and Tell got started. Show and Tell, which is open, alternately known as Open Mic Show and Tell. We kind of scrapped the open mic because people get the wrong idea sometimes with that term. but the spirit of it's still the spirit of an open mic, and Open Mic Show and Tell is exactly what it sounds like. People can bring an object of personal significance and talk about it for up to 3 minutes. And we've all done show and tell in second grade or whenever, and so everybody's familiar with the format. The 3-minute rule is mainly to ensure, just like in second grade, that nobody hogs the stage, nobody kind of gets too much attention. And the 3-minute rule will be enforced semi-strictly with this egg timer. And I usually get things started with a few show and tells of my own to show the range of what show and tell can be, because people often ask me, you know, what should I bring? I've thought about coming, but I don't want to come because I don't have the perfect object. And it's so not about the object. Show and tell is about the story. It's a storytelling mechanism. And objects can range from the personal to the eccentric to the banal to anywhere in between. And I've brought a few examples from all of those categories. I'm going to start with the personal. This is a wooden dog, a carved dog, and it has some significance in my family. I used to have a brother and a sister-in-law who were deceased, unfortunately, and when they passed away, this is what I really wanted from their home, and the reason I wanted it was the story behind it. My brother was coming home from the subway one day. They lived in Cobble Hill, and he stopped in a junk shop and saw this, and he came home to his wife, my sister-in-law, and said, I saw this great carved wooden dog, but it was a little too much money. The guy wanted too much money for it, so I didn't buy it. And the next day, he apparently came home and stopped on the way back from the subway and again sort of looked at the dog, fondled the dog, drooled over the dog, and said, I looked at the dog, but it was a little too much money. Third day, same thing, same story. After that, my sister-in-law had decided that was enough. She went and bought the dog. And my brother came home on the fourth day and said, dog is gone. Somebody bought the dog. And my sister-in-law said, oh, that's too bad, honey. That's rough. And then she kept it in a closet for about 7 months until his birthday and gave it to him. And one reason I love the story is because it involves both my brother and my sister-in-law, but it also really captures the essence of both of them. My sister-in-law had a great poker face and had the ability to keep something in a closet and had the discipline not to spring it, you know, before then, which I would not have the discipline to do. My brother was a bit of a practical guy, and when he says that it was too much money, I never did hear how much it cost, but I'm guessing it was about $4, and he was trying to probably hoping to dicker the guy down to $2. So it kind of captures the essence of what made them special. And the object itself is very special. It has these little carved claw pads that a dog has. It has these Asian characters painted on it. It has a tail carved into it. And it opens up, and it has a secret compartment. So I'll pass it around. And it's a nice object. What makes it special to me is the story behind it. And so that's an example of a personal show and tell. You can also have a show and tell of a sort of unusual object. This is something known as the UPSIT, which is the University of Pennsylvania Smell Identification Test. And it is the gold standard for measuring olfactory function, in America at least. And what I learned about it when I was doing an article, I'm a journalist, I was doing an article about a guy who had lost his sense of smell. And I learned that this was the gold standard. And what's great about it is that it's basically a series of scratch and sniffs. And it's sort of fascinatingly dinky and analog. It just couldn't be more simple. And it's also this sort of nice design with these colored leafed papers. But I couldn't believe that the most highly respected olfactory function doctor in New York City was using essentially a scratch and sniff to measure. It was sort of unbelievable that it was that simple. I'll pass it around. It has passed its expiration date, which I have. It must have been written on the envelope. It's past its expiration date, but it still works. So if you have a coin or even your fingernail or whatever, if you want to scratch any of the panels, you can. Just sort of an interesting thing, something most of us don't think about in terms of, you wouldn't expect that to be a highly sensitive medical measurer. And in terms of the banal, I usually say most people have a good show and tell in their pocket, and I certainly do. And it's this quarter, which I received on Halloween Day, 1987. It was my first year in New York City. I had moved here earlier that year, and I went to the Halloween parade, which was a little less of a project than it is now. And I was there with some friends, and we were sitting on the side, or standing along the parade route, and watching the people in the costumes. And some guy came by. There were people distributing things, assorted things, as part of the parade. And one guy came by distributing tiny Ziploc bags. And each one had a quarter in it and a small slip of paper. And he handed one to each of us. And I opened mine. And it said, in case of emergency, call this number. And it turned out to be the number for a runaway hotline. And of course, in 1987, there were no cell phones yet. And everyone used pay phones. And so if you were a runaway, if you needed help, you'd need to call this number, and you'd need a quarter to use the payphone. And so he was promoting his runaway hotline. And my quarter, for some reason, had this hole drilled in it. I don't know why. It was just that way. And it's right in the middle of George Washington's head, so it's like he's gotten a lobotomy. And it's a 1983 quarter. So it was 4 years old at the time. It has now spent 24 and a half years on my keychain, a lot longer time than it was in circulation. And so it was an emergency quarter. It was distributed as an emergency quarter. And I decided to make it my emergency quarter. I put it on my keychain so I'd always have it in case I needed a quarter. It's been around the world with me, whenever I travel, because it's on my keychain. And I've always wondered if I were to use it in a payphone or in any coin-operated gadget, would it work? Because it no longer weighs the same as a quarter, because it has this little divot taken out of it. And most coin-operated gadgets are highly calibrated, and of course, because it has a hole in it, I could tie a string to it and drop it in and see if it worked, and then pull it back out. But the truth is, I don't really want to know. I just like wondering if it would still work. And sometimes that's the best part of a show and tell, or of any object or any story, is not really knowing the answer, but just pondering the question. And so that's an example of some things that show and tell can be. The way we usually, I'll pass this around too. I definitely need this back. The way we usually get started is we've got people, seven people in addition to myself, who've signed up on the sign-up sheet. When I step down from here, I will call the next person. That person will come up and will hopefully take the egg timer and turn it over. And we'll turn this around so everyone can see the egg timer without this lip. And that person will get to see the sands of time slipping away, as we all will. It's not a strictly enforced limit. We don't have a gong. We don't have one of those hooks. But the idea is to keep things moving. And then when you're done, you can just call the next person on the list. When we get through the list, we'll take a little intermission. We'll hear some more music. We'll drink some more beer. And then what usually happens is that people who think they're here just to be shown and told realize that they want to show and tell. And maybe some of you are already thinking that you're falling into that category. And so if that happens, you can just come up to me during the break and say, I think I'd like to participate, and we'll have you participate after the break. And I'm sure many of you have things in your bags or your purses or your pockets that will fit the bill. And you'll see that show and tell tends to bring out a very non-threatening, friendly audience. Did I just drop something? No. Okay. So we're going to get started with the next person, who is Julie Threlkeld. And we'll get... put all these things down long enough to give her a hand.
I'm really tempted to tell a story about this egg timer, actually. Okay. So my father left us when I was eight, and my parents were amicably divorced. My sister and I saw my father fairly frequently in San Francisco on divorced father Sundays until he moved to New York. After that, I used to come and spend a few weeks with him every summer in the city. And they were typically sort of awkward visits, but since it was about the only time I ever saw him, they were very important to me. But the whole time I was growing up, I thought that he had regretted having a family. My parents had gotten married fairly young and had us very young, and my dad was very career-oriented. When I decided to move to the city when I was 18, partially to try to repair our relationship, it really didn't surprise me that even though we were both now living in the same city, I still only saw him for dinner about once or twice a year. And I just figured I was still out of sight, out of mind. So I was very surprised when I saw him for dinner one night around my 21st birthday, and he presented me with this gift. This is a Noah's Ark that he bought on a trip to Peru. And it was extremely unusual for him to give me a gift. He typically sent me a birthday card with a check. And it's such a strange gift. It's so whimsical, and neither of us is religious, but he was down in Peru on this trip, and he saw this and apparently thought of me enough to buy it and bring it home. Unfortunately, it got damaged on the trip home in his luggage. If you look carefully, you can see that one of the giraffe necks has snapped off, and it's been very hastily and badly glued back on. This object is really kind of proof to me that he did think about me at times other than when I was sitting across the table from him in a Manhattan restaurant, and that he did care about fixing things. If my house ever catches on fire, this is one of the objects I will probably grab on the way out. And I should also tell you that my father, Richard Carroll Kell, died in a car accident about 2 months ago. A lot of people wanted to speak at his memorial service, which was great, but it meant that I had to keep my eulogy very short and had to cut a lot of stories that I wanted to tell about him. And this is one of the stories I wanted to tell. So thank you for letting me tell it here tonight. In fact, I was nervous, so I left out that part of the story. In fact, I have it written here right on my hand. yes, he actually, part of what, unfortunately, I fucked up the story, but anyway. part of what I love about this object is that I am distressed at thinking about how he felt when he took this out of his luggage and realized that it was broken. But I really love the thought of him running out and buying a tube of crazy glue and sitting there somewhat panicked, gluing this thing back together. And I think that's why he did such a botched job, because I think he rushed to the job. So. Any questions? Okay, so Tim M.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tim. The object I want to talk about is this hat. It's wool cap, and it was made in Scotland, but that's not where I got it. I got it at my grandparents' house in Chicago. I was there visiting just after my grandfather, Papa, passed away, and this was his hat, and it was one of the... it's the only physical object that I have in my life that was once his, that reminds me of him on a daily basis. I wear it all the time. I actually have several that are like this with different patterns. I took a whole stack of them because he wore them all the time too. And it's something that I've kind of worked into my wardrobe, not because I have a particular fixation with caps, but more because it reminds me of him. This was somebody that I always loved when I was a kid, and feel like the older I get, the more that I come to respect him and miss him more as time goes on. And when I wear the hat, it makes me feel a little bit closer to him, and also makes me feel like, you know, he wore this, and he was such an amazing person. It makes me feel like if I wear it, you know, maybe some of that will rub off. That's what I'm hoping for. I don't know. And I've actually recently started to think that this is maybe the type of object that has such significance to me that maybe I should shelve it, put it away somewhere so that it doesn't get blown off on the bridge and, you know, into the river, and then I never see it again. Although I think if I told that to Papa, he would just laugh. He'd think that was ridiculous, that I was placing so much value in a hat that he probably didn't think too much about. But I've been thinking about maybe putting it away, but I've made a decision not to, because the reason why it's valuable for me is not just in looking at it, but actually in the act of wearing it. And I think to put it away would, you know, I would lose that. And the value that I get from it, yeah, like I said, the value I get from it is in wearing it. It makes me feel like I'm that much closer to, you know, achieving the same kind of, I don't know. I guess I'm still figuring it out. but it makes me feel something. And yeah, and that's why this hat is so important to me. So thank you for letting me share it with you. Oh, questions? Well, it's hard to say because.
Did you ever tell him?
Well, he's passed away now.
Right, but when he was alive.
But I was young. You know, it was maybe. I mean, this was almost 10 years ago, and so it's actually only recently that I've sort of felt old enough to even wear the hat at all. But I think that you know, it's almost like my relationship with him has changed and matured, even after his death. Which is not something that I would have thought could even happen. I wish I could tell him. Maybe, you know. Yeah. Anybody else? That's amazing. Yeah. Cool. Thanks again. Yeah.
I brought a photograph. I know Paul because I used to volunteer at the City Reliquary. So like Paul, I've shared a fair amount of objects when I used to go kind of help out with that show. And I was trying to think tonight what have I had an object that I've carried as an adult from apartment to apartment? And I can only think of one, and it was this object, and it's a photograph of my brother and I. My brother is a few years younger than I am. And when I was little, I had really terrible nightmares, and I don't remember the nightmares. I don't remember what they were about. But my parents thought to soothe the nightmares, if they put my brother in bed with me, I would like cuddle up to him, and I would fall asleep like without any nightmares. And so my brother and I slept together in the same bed until I was probably 12, which is like a long time, and I didn't realize that was unusual growing up. But we would cuddle up to each other on our little faces and go to bed with our little noses rubbing, and we would talk. We would stay up and talk to each other, and obviously that's like really intimate and wonderful. And along the way, I lost my nightmares and grew up. But when I was leaving to go to college, I didn't know that this picture existed. It's a picture of us just like, you know, face to face. I didn't know it existed, and my brother had it. He had this picture in his room. And he told me that he'd had the picture in his room taped up against his bed, which was like so sentimental and so sweet. And so when I went to college, he was like, I'm gonna give it to you, so I'll be with you, like as an adult. And I went to college, and then I moved, and then I moved to go to graduate school. And along the way, I realized I'd lost the picture. And I was just like heartbroken that I'd lost this picture. And I mentioned to my grandmother a few years ago, I lost this picture. And she was like, I took that picture. I took the picture and I have like one original copy. And so after this, she said she searched her basement and like finally found this picture. And just last year, she sent this to me. And so I have this picture again. And I used to carry it from apartment to apartment and put it right next to my bed. And so now I have it back. And so that's where it lives. And that's my story. Next up is going to be also Tim, unless you have any questions.
Hi, my name is Tim, also Tim. The object I've brought is not something I can pass around because it's a part of my body. But afterwards, if you'd like me to show it to you, I could show it to you. But it's the palm on the skin of my right hand, which is slightly mangled. I don't know if you can see that. There's some redness in some blisters that have formed here, 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 and here. And the cause of them is that I just moved to New York City 2 weeks ago, and I was looking for a job. And a friend of mine is a cook, and she's working at a new clam shack, which is actually coincidentally down the street from here. And she said, oh, we're hiring someone. So I said, well, I'll do anything. I'll shuck oysters. I'll chop onions. I'd never worked in a kitchen before, but I thought it would be interesting. It would be exciting. And I kind of wanted to do it for the sake of revenge because of a former friend of mine who I'm separated from also had visions of becoming a cook in a restaurant. I could do this before her. So I ate my first oyster on the Saturday. I started working at this. I went to Trail at this restaurant. And then I had my first night of work there about 8 days ago on Thursday, and I started shucking the oysters, and it's very difficult. I thought it was kind of like my experiences trying to, well, have sex with people, because you have to just, in order to get to the point where you can have a sexual experience with someone, you need this aggressive, specific force to this very narrow aspect of the oyster, and then you get it, you dig it in and turn it, and then it breaks, and once it breaks and the shell's popped, it can't be put back together. But then there's this slimy, wet, sacred, mysterious, energizing thing that you have access to. But the blisters started to form, and they started to get a little infected, and my hand has been in pain for about 5 days, and I'm still getting used to everything. And I think if I can get through this weekend and get through the second week of work, I'll have it down, and I'll figure it out. But I'm still struggling with it. My hand still hurts, but I'm getting better at it, and I hope to maybe become graceful with the oyster shucking. But this is my object. Thank you. It's called Little Neck, the restaurant. It's on 3rd Avenue, 200-something 3rd Avenue. It's very close to here. It's really close to here. The next person is Rupert.
Okay. I'm not going to show the object right away. I'm going to talk about it because I've not been here before, so I'm going to mostly tell then show. I was in Cairo, and it's downtown Cairo has a great collection of colonial architecture embalmed in the pervasive desert dust, and all these details will be relevant to what I'm going to show you. All that dust has the effect that people in the upper stories of the buildings keep their windows closed to keep the dust out. The only lighting that comes in downtown is coming from the street level, so you've got this light coming up, and then there are the giant billboards on the top of the buildings also providing the light, and it's eerily reminiscent sans rain of Ridley Scott's dystopian vision of Blade Runner. So walking around the streets of Cairo, going past a doorway, I see a cabinet covered in a layer of sepia snow, like dust all over it, and sort of archaeological curiosity. I was there working on an archaeological dig. I plunge in and said, what the hell is in this cabinet? There's all these little doors slightly ajar of stuff in there. It's an art supply store. I'm an artist as well, so that made it more fun. So I start pulling things out. There's a little ink jar, dried up nub of color rattling around inside it. Another jar, still liquid, but sealed with a glob of wax. Stamped tin palette. So I'm looking at art supplies from the beginning of the 20th century. Little corner of gold catches my eye, and I reach in and pull it out. And I pull out this little packet, a little envelope, and it's illuminating watercolor, fine gold, Winsor & Newton. The proprietor of the place had just sacrificed this cabinet to the dust, conducted business at the back, was just amused at me looking at all this stuff. I tried to buy the thing off him. He said, no, just I can't sell that to my current customers, just take it. So I wander back to my hotel, up in a balcony, flaking Corinthian columns at my back. I think, well, maybe this actually has real gold in it, maybe it'll be valuable. So I carefully peel it open. I got actually two of them, so I don't want to open this one. So I peel it open, but I was completely not expecting what I'd find inside. So maybe some of you, this won't be a surprise, but it was a surprise to me. Out fell a mussel shell, like shellfish, blue and iridescent, and a little dot of gold dried in the rim. I was like, wow, so somebody solved the packaging problem 80 years ago with a mussel shell. And then I thought about this mussel shell, like, well, here's where our dystopian Blade Runner and our colonial past sort of converge. Like, this thing is not actually a view to the past. I look at this thing, like, that could be the future. Like, what would it take for us to reuse mussel shells as packaging? Like, not to go to some glorified colonial past, or, you know, that the past has its problems, it's not just perfect, nor also the idea that the future is all hell and we're stuck using mussel shells because it's all we've got, a la Blade Runner's dystopian vision. But what about just the idea that you don't need every goddamn thing to be the same, and that you have a tolerance for variation, and that mussel shells are as good a package as anything? Thanks. Any questions? Jamie is next.
My object is this scarf, which is completely usual, and many women in Brooklyn have scarves that look exactly like this. After college, well, I saved all this money to travel for a year on my own after college, and I went to Ghana and Western Europe, and then I was in India, and I was there, and I was writing grants for small nonprofits for lesbian women in India. And along the way, I was going to another nonprofit to do something else, and so I had the opportunity to kind of be on vacation. So I went to Jaipur, which is this absolutely beautiful town, and I arrived there, and I was walking around like Western women walk around, you know, just like really amazed. And this guy came up to me, and he was very and he started, you know, chatting with me. And of course, I'm like, a local! This is so fabulous! So we started becoming friends. And he invited me to his home. And of course, I mean, that's just fabulous. So I went to his home. And there was like just 5% of my mind thinking this is not a good idea. But the 95% is like, this is the best thing that's happened so far. So I arrive, and his family was extremely poor. They were 7 children and 2 adults sleeping on 1 mattress, and many of the children had skin diseases, which totally grossed me out, to be quite honest. And so, but I went with all of these children down to the fruit stands, and we bought massive amounts of fruit. It was like $2, but they were thrilled. And so we came back, and we made all of this fruit, and we made this big bowl of fruit, and it was like gigantic. It was like, you know, when you go to a restaurant in New York and like they make salad for like 25 people at a time, it was like that big of a bowl. And so we made this huge salad, and then people just dove in, and we were all eating it with our hands all at the same time, and it was just beautiful. And they put all this makeup on me and dressed me up. And in any case, so that happened the first day. And then the second day, his name was Sonny. He took me to, he said, you know, do you want to buy textiles and saris? I know this place that has antique saris. Do you want to buy, you know, a beautiful antique sari? And I said, thinking like, do you know who I am? I'm a Western woman traveling alone by myself for a year. Of course I want an antique sari. You know, so we go and we go to this place and they have these beautiful old saris, and I chose one out, and the man said, you know, but you need to get beadwork done on this. So I paid them. He had 50% up front. So I paid him, and then I came home to my hostel that evening, and my new hostel friend said, ma'am, you have been taken. No, this can't possibly be true. But I woke up in the morning and I realized, oh my God, I have been taken. How did this happen? And so I found one of the driver who sort of knew about Sunny and knew, and he gave me the look like, yeah, it happened to you. So I went to the place. He finally took me. He knew the place because Sunny takes everybody to this place. And I came in and I said, I want my antique sari. I paid you 50%, da 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 da. And the man wasn't willing to give it to me. And I said, you better go up there and you better find something beautiful and bring it down to me now if you're not going to give me the antique sari. And he brought me this scarf. Let's see. Sam.
Wait.
Oh, we have a question.
And do you like it?
I love this scarf. And I have to say, there was one day... No, it's a beautiful scarf, actually. And this winter, or last winter, I have three stepdaughters, and one of them was very cold, and I was wearing the scarf. And she was very cold, because, of course, all teenagers are very cold in the winter. And I gave her the scarf, and I had to tell her, do not lose this scarf. I'm telling you. So, I love the scarf. Yeah.
How much did you pay?
I paid it. I think I paid about $200 for the scarf.
I went to the same place. That scarf would cost you $5.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, the facts and truth are different. Anyway, so Sam is next.
About 8 years ago, I went to China for the first time. And for anyone who hasn't been, it's just, you know, so many people and so many, you know, like, it's just crazy. But what really stuck out at me, being young, is how cheap everything is. And so I would just go, whether it was electronics or it was food or whatever it was, I was just, oh, this is 30 cents and 20 cents and 50 cents, and now it's, you know, I want to live here and this is great and, you know, this and that. And so I like to collect knickknacks at home. And there's no theme, and it's not necessarily old things or new things, it's just whatever catches my eye. And so I just wanted to show you two examples. At first I was thinking that this kind of, because I move a lot, these are two things I've kept with me. Why? I don't know, you know, traveling and moving. At first I was thinking these are the best and the worst things I've purchased for 50 cents US. But then I was thinking about it more, and they're not necessarily the best and worst. They're just, you know, two things that have stuck with me. So the first, and I apologize if you've seen these. They're not antiques or anything. This I got in Malaysia, actually, and I had to dig through all these LED squishy, you know, whatever it is, or electric erasers and all these things, and I found this ball, and it really impressed me by the way it captures physics. It's blue, but when you throw it to somebody, it turns green, and it freaked me out. It's so cool. I don't even know how it works. I mean, it's just like back and forth, and you can play with it all day. And I carried this around with me for like 8 weeks, and it didn't break, and it's just really marvelous and so cool. And then the other thing, so I thought, okay, I got one thing. Yeah, great, this is good. And then I was in Shanghai, and there are these huge markets, and they sell mostly Mao-related things. So they'll sell these old locks, and then they'll sell books of Mao sayings and things like that. So I thought I would get something not too kitschy, but still kind of authentic. And I got this Mao ashtray. That's, you know, nice metal ashtray. It's got a picture of Mao on it. And I've kept it. And last year, so about 7 years after I bought it, the sticker of Mao started to peel back. So I peeled off a little bit. And you can see at the top, it says AC Milano. And it has these picture of soccer players on it. And so... at first I was thinking, so not only is this, you know, like a fake Mao ashtray, but then it's like a fake of a fake. Did they buy this and then they repurposed it, just stuck a Mao sticker on it and said, oh, I can double the price. So, and so it's kind of now half AC Milano, half Mao. And it just sits around, and maybe I'll find a third sticker under there one day. I don't know. And I thought that was my worst purchase because I say, oh, it's so fake, but I don't know, you know, makes you wonder. So that's it. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, sure. And oh, looks like I was the last one.
Yeah, that's the last of Sam was the last of Act One of Show and Tell. We'll take a little break, and I know some people were, because they told me so, were thinking about maybe showing and telling, and maybe others have felt inspired to show and tell. So we'll take a little break, go to the bathroom, have another beer, whatever, and if anybody wants to participate, just come up and find me in the next 10 minutes or so, and we'll set you up. Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
pen was this? Started again. We do have a bunch more people who want to show and tell, and before we get to them, first, I'm going to pass this around with a pen. It's a show and tell email list, and underneath it is the cabinet email list. And if you want to, what? Thanks, Jamie. If you want to be on either or both, please sign up. If you don't want to be, that's fine too. But if you get on one, you do not necessarily get on the other. So if you want to be on both, please sign both. Show and tell will happen once a month. Cabinet is a wonderful, wonderful arts magazine. It comes out quarterly and is run and founded by a gentleman in the back, Sina Najafi. Sina, what's the theme of the current issue? So if you don't subscribe to Cabinet, punishment would be a good theme. For those who haven't noticed, I'll point out that the shelving behind the bar spells out the word cabinet rather brilliantly. It's one of my favorite things about this space. And Cabinet, aside from the magazine, which I encourage everybody to subscribe to and read and buy copies of, which I think some are for sale here, does lots of great events like this one and many greater events than this one. So it's a mailing list worth being on. As far as the show and tell mailing list, we do this once a month. We're going to do it for what, the next 2 or 3 months here, Sina?
2 or 3,
still being negotiated. I promise not to pepper people with spam and all that kind of stuff, but once or twice a month I'll give people an update. So we're going to get started with another group of people, and I'll get it started with a show and tell of objects that I found in the pocket of a coat I recently bought. I was at Beacon's Closet down on Fifth Avenue, which many of you may be familiar with, and I saw a coat that I kind of liked the look of. I liked the pattern. I wasn't sure about the color. I put it on. And, well, it fits pretty good, but I don't know about this color. I wish I should have brought the coat with me. It's a color I don't normally wear. And then I felt there was something in the pocket. And I pulled out the something and basically saw this, which was like folded like this. It was wrapped around all these other things. And I could see it was an old check, handwritten. And that was really all I needed to see. I went and bought the coat. And I put everything back in the pocket, and I didn't look at it until I got home, when I found not just a check or a canceled check, but a bounced check. And there's like a rubber stamp on it with a check mark under NSF, which of course means insufficient funds. And the check was made out to Bell of Penna, meaning Pennsylvania Bell. It was for a phone bill. $23.23 bounced check from 1976. Signed in the name, a joint checking account from Ronald Krosnewski and Anne-Marie Krosnewski. Also, Ronald Krosnewski's time card from the time clock, of whatever job he had, it doesn't indicate what his job was. Also, a teeny tiny shopping list. Paper towels, coffee, sugar, dog food, milk, cheese, soups, cereal. So it's kind of like the staple, like the classic staples. Another shopping list on the flap of an envelope. You can see like all the glue and everything. Dog food, milk, bread, cig, period. A receipt from the local Sherwin Williams for Style Perfect Latex, something something green accent 4492, 1 gallon for $10.99, and then a paint swatch panel with a check mark on Tivoli Green 4492. So this apparently is what they bought a gallon of.
It's the 70s.
Yeah, exactly. And I was curious, so I Googled Ronald and Anne-Marie Krasnewski, from, and the check has an address in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. First, I want to see if they still live there. They don't. I found an obituary for Ronald Krasnewski, who died just last December in South Carolina, where he had moved. It lists Anne-Marie as a survivor. So she's still alive. And I know where she is, and I have her phone number in South Carolina and her address. And I considered, you know, what should I do? I could send this back. It's a little unusual knowing that someone has bounced a check. It's sort of a record of shame. And so I didn't really want to hang that over her or bring her face to face with it. And her husband just died a few months ago. And the one thing I thought could be interesting was this, you know, that this color has got to bring back some memories for somebody, right? Like, you're going to remember when you painted the room that color. And I thought about it, and I decided it would be a little selfish to make contact with her, that I wouldn't. I might get something out of it, but what would she get out of it? She'd get the shame of the bounce check and some kind of memory of her husband who just died, and it just didn't. It didn't seem quite right. It seemed like it would be a little indulgent, and so I didn't pursue it. I blogged about it, and I posted scans of all these objects, and somebody who saw what I wrote said that he was also from the same town, Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and participates in a message board of local history, local culture, and so forth from that town. And so he offered to post my blog post on that board and see if anyone responded, if anybody knew the Krasnewski family and so on. And he did that, but no one has responded. And so I think I'm going to let that just... going to let it be, yeah. It just doesn't seem right. I feel like it would be that I'd get, like I said, I'd get more out of it than Anne-Marie would, and that doesn't seem right. And now you all know that Anne-Marie Krasnewski bounced the check, which is a little, so I'm not sure if that makes it worse. It probably does. I'm going to pass this around. I ask that you please keep it as a set and be gentle with all of it, because some of the pages are, you know, starting to crack or tear or whatever. But anyway, pretty good show and tell to find in the pocket of a vintage jacket, right? So we have a bunch more people who want to participate, and the first of them is Aaron.
So I guess the fun part about the second group is we're probably the introverts that didn't really want to do this, but are forcing ourselves to. So I didn't actually come with an object to talk about because I didn't know I was coming and didn't know that I would be showing and telling. But I thought I would tell you about a story that was really about show and tell. So I'm telling about show and tell. But when I was in second grade, speaking of this whole topic of show and tell, I came to class with my pet millipede. I had just gotten it about a week ago, and I don't know if you guys have ever seen a millipede close up, but they're pretty fascinating, really. They're like, you know, nice, silky black. You turn them over, and they actually have all these tiny little bugs, red bugs, that are living on the millipede that clean and eat, you know, the grime and dirt off of them. They eat iceberg lettuce. They give off this kind of weird smell. Whenever I'm in the forest and I can smell this millipede smell immediately, it just brings back memories of my pet millipede, Millie. And so I brought Millie to class, and I had him crawling all over my friends, and everyone seemed to love it. I was surprised no one was really terrified of Millie, but it was a lot of fun. And I remember, you know, I brought him home that day, and he just wasn't moving quite the same without that energy that he had earlier in the day. And I told my mom, and my mom was like, "Oh, that's strange. I'll take him to the vet." So my mom takes Millie to the vet, and she brings him back, and she says, "Look, he's fine. We gave him some medicine, and he's all good." And I was really relieved. And, you know, I had Millie for at least a year or two longer until I went on a ski trip and forgot to feed him iceberg lettuce. I mean, you only have to feed him once every week or so, but I was gone for two and killed Millie. So that was the end of Millie. And about 5-10 years later, I finally found out that my mom went to the pet store and bought another millipede because it only cost $10. And, you know, that was the story of Millie. And I just still have, like, that much resentment to my mom that she couldn't actually tell me that it died and that, you know, at some point in my life I could learn how to cope with death. And I don't know. I think that's why I still have problems with it. But that's about it. Any questions? They're like, you know, 6 to 9 inches, maybe a half of an inch in diameter, not 1,000 legs, even though you would be led to think that it would have probably like 200 or so. And they move in kind of a wave-like motion. It's really pretty incredible. They don't bite. No head, really. You can't distinguish. Uh-huh.
Are you like totally anti-centipede?
I hate centipedes. Yeah. Honestly, centipedes are really scary. Millipedes are the most friendly. Like you.
Centipedes.
Yeah, they have like claws on the front. The millipede's like double-ended. You really can't tell what's the head and what's the butt. But yeah.
When are you getting your next?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm too transient right now to get another one, but maybe one day. Uh-huh.
Have you talked to your mother about this?
I haven't really. Not too much. No. I should. Yeah. Thanks, guys. Lisa?
So, my father, when I was in high school, sat my sister and I down and said, and told us that he'd been having an affair for years with my mother's best friend. And I was furious. I'm probably still furious a little bit. And he went through all of these motions to try to better himself and figure out why he did this. And it was many women, it wasn't just this one woman. Why he did this, men's groups, he went to Kabbalah, he went to therapy. And about a year later, he decided that it'd be helpful in the process of helping the family through this to take my sister and I to a father-daughter retreat. And he'd been learning about Kabbalah, and I guess in the Kabbalah there's something about forgiveness, where when you ask for forgiveness, you can ask 7 times, and always in more public settings. So the first time it's a private interaction, and then as time goes on, you can ask in front of more people. And if you're still not granted forgiveness, and at the 7th try in front of everybody you know, then you're not going to get it. So we were sitting around this campfire at the father-daughter retreat, and he gave me this object, and it's a bone, and it's worn down, and I don't know what kind of bone it is. Maybe you can tell me. It was a tool at one point. It has these ridges in the end of it, and I think that was probably the 3rd time he'd asked for my forgiveness for this. And so I have this phone, and it reminds me that forgiveness is a process. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
asked me about 5 times. I was pretty angry.
What does the bone represent for you, this
one? It's just the sim. It's just reminds me that he asked.
What did it represent for him?
He likes that it was worn down. It's touched a lot of hands. And he didn't know what it was for either, but I think he just liked that it had had a lot of energy in it from somewhere, somehow. Yeah. So if you know what kind of bone it is, I'd like to know.
Story, and it's about this hat. So one day I wear this hat out, just bought it, you know, the first time, as a gift, and then I saw another woman wearing the exact same hat, so I gave a war cry, and goes like, and the woman was terrified. She just ran away.
My dry cleaning lady calls me Heatler because she can't spell Heather. She writes Heatler and calls me Heatler. So I'll pass this around, but this is a card I've been carrying one version or another of for about 25 years. It's a date card. And so when I was 11 or 12, my big brother, who was 21, gave me this card. He hadn't dated yet at all. And so he guessed maybe he had no use for the date card. And it says this: if you keep this card, I get a date. If you give it back, I get a kiss. If you throw it away, I get both. When do I collect? And the bottom is just a statement. There's no question mark. It's when do I collect in all caps, really big. And I've always loved that there's no question mark. Like, it's like the asker is just confused. But anyway, so I carried, this is not the original. It was paper, and it he'd had it for a, you know, since he was a kid, I guess from the 60s. So his version was really old. It felt like a t-shirt. It was so old and cottony. And I insisted on showing it to all my friends at slumber parties, and so it got more and more cottony, like a tissue. I thought it was just going to tear, you know, rip in two. So once in college, I decided I just needed to duplicate it and make a trillion of these. So I went to the copy maven and got dozens of them made and laminated. And the young man who was, I was like, I don't know, 20 or something, the guy was a teenager, and he was like slicing the sheets of the laminated date card. Sorry, we'll just assume I'm out. But and he's looking at them like, what? And he's looking at me, and I can tell he really is intrigued by the date card. And so I look at him and I say, do you want one? And he reads it. He's like, I have a girlfriend. I'm like, that's not even what I was offering. But anyway, so the date card, and yes, my older brother is still single. So here you go. Next up.
What about the Q&A?
Oh yeah, well, next up is Nancy, but any questions?
So he didn't make it? It came from, you know,
he got it from someone else. So I don't know how old the original is, and it's still in an old wallet of mine, and it still feels like a tissue. Yes?
How is it supposed to be used? Like, how does he get it back?
So if I give it to a fellow, if there's someone who's the apple of my eye and I give it to the guy, what does it say? If you keep this card, I get a date?
Mm-hmm. He gets it.
So
brother gets
if,
a date.
No, well, so my brother gave it to me, and that's the first weird part. I was prepubescent, so that's kind of gross. But so anyway, it never worked for me. I mean, I gave it out all the time.
You did,
but
give it out.
I gave it out left and right. Yeah, but you know, no success.
My dad, in the 50s and 60s, had a pharmacy in the Catskills in our little town where I grew up, and he would always get these great advertising, you know, just objects. And one that I got after a while was this blow-up doll for this cold medication called Coriban D, and it had this big long nose that was red. I mean, it was like a little guy with this big long nose, and it was. He hung it in the store. You know, you had to blow it up, and he hung it in the store, and I just coveted it so much, and eventually got it. But and we also had Speedy Alka-Seltzer, little icon, little doll, and I don't have that unfortunately, but I do have a measuring tape thing that says, always display Tums for the tummy. And it has a level on top, and it says, add 2 inches, so to your measurement. And it used to work really well. Now it doesn't go back. But so my dad died in 1965, and my mom sold the store. But I still have this. And I basically grabbed it on the way out of the house today because I knew this was something Paul would love because he loves advertising stuff. And it's got nice heft to it and everything. It's just a cool item, so. You know, I did. And then when it stopped retracting, I just bought a new one. But I still wanted to keep it, of course.
Where in the Catskills?
Ellenville.
Ellenville. Ah, my dad's from Liberty.
Very good. Next county, but still, that's okay.
My grandmother used to talk about Ellenville as if it were like the place. Like when you made it to Ellenville. My dad always shook his head. He's like, it's like Liberty.
It's, well, you know, it's a pretty dipshit town, but it had the Neville. Country Club and the Falls View, its sister hotel, and they had a round building that's sort of like the Capitol building in L.A. at the Neville, so that was cool. And one time, Cousin Brucey went there, so that was the biggest day in the town's history, except for when LBJ came. But really, I mean, it's funny because wherever you go in the world, people have heard of this dinky little Catskills town of 5,000 people, which is now a town of 4,000 people. So, yeah, it's lost population. But anyway, Ellenville.
I don't think there's anyone else on the list.
This gentleman wanted to go first. What's your name?
Adele. I'd like to share my book. I took a 30-day vow of silence in October of 2010, and this is the only way I communicated for the entire 30 days, besides gesturing, telling people, like, you got it. And for a few days, I actually tried to mouth words until I felt that it was cheating. If there's one thing I learned in the entire 30 days of doing this, it's that while 90% of body language is nonverbal, gestures do not mean a thing. You can try them. If you're not speaking when doing them, they don't do a bit of good for anyone. A lot of people take this as very heavy, so I'm going to tell a quick story about this that's kind of funny. I transcribed this, and while this is pretty much entire conversations, it turns out that every conversation is only about a sentence long, because when you're tired of writing everything all day, you try to shorten it as much as possible. Anyhow, this is a very quick conversation I had with someone. I'm mute, but it isn't because I'm sucking dick. What happened was, on the day before the very last day, it was the day before Halloween, I was walking down the street and a carload of guys drive up and start calling me names. I don't respond. So one of them says, are you not I smiled at them, and they say, are you not replying or not coming back with anything because there's a dick in your mouth? So I quickly scribbled this, walked up to them, and slammed it on their window, and I've never seen anybody drive away faster than that. That's it.
Are you willing to pass the book around?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Why
am
I
out
of silence?
Is there anybody else who wants to show and tell? Okay, I'm going to do a quick tell. I can't show because I don't have the object, and you'll see that's sort of the point of the story. When I was little, my mom, like many moms in their kitchens, had a cupboard for spices, her spice cupboard. And, you know, where she had her oregano and her cinnamon and all that. And she also had a vanilla bean, and it was in a test tube, just like vanilla beans are sold today. You've probably seen them. And to me, it looked like this incredibly exotic thing. And if you've seen a vanilla bean, you know, it's sort of withered, and it is somewhat exotic looking. And I'd never seen anything like it. I'd never seen my mom cook with it. It just lived in the cupboard. And my mom watched cooking shows sometimes, and I'd seen those, and I'd never seen anyone use a vanilla bean in one of those either. And I asked her, and she said, well, it's for a very special recipe, and I just haven't made anything like that lately. And years went by, and the vanilla bean was always still there in the cupboard, and I would ask my mom, why do you hold on to that? And she said, well, you know, I might need it one day. I might need that to do that recipe one day. And a lot of years went by, like a lot of years. And I went to college, and I'd come home, and it got to be sort of a routine that I'd come home from college or come home from, you know, after I moved to Brooklyn, I'd come home, and I'd sort of make a beeline for the spice cupboard and check to see that the test tube with the vanilla bean was still there. And I'd say, Ma, like, come on, with the bean, huh? And she'd say, well, I don't know why it bothers you so much. I'm just keeping it, you know, I might need, it's fine there. It's, you know, it's sealed. It's not hurting anybody. And my parents were Depression Jews, which is kind of a double whammy of thriftiness. So my mom wasn't really inclined to throw a lot of things out, you know, whether as long as it might still be useful. She wasn't a hoarder, per se, but if something had value or potential value, she was going to hold on to it. And the vanilla bean that she could cook with certainly fit the bill. And one day, I came home, and I went to the spice cupboard, and I was sort of rooting around, and no bean, no vanilla bean. And I said, Mom, where's the bean? And she said, well, you were always bugging me about it, and I decided you were probably right. It was silly, and there was no need to keep it, and I don't cook that way anymore. And so I got rid of it. And I felt so bad. Number one, this thing had assumed kind of metaphysical properties. You know, that it was somehow, it was one of the few constants I could take for granted in the universe, was that the bean would be there in the spice cupboard. And I missed it, that it was, you know, somehow its absence indicated, you know, an upsetting of the universal order. And also, it had become something of a connection between my mother and myself. But most of all, I felt bad that I had made my mother, who's not a silly person, feel silly and feel bad that I'd sort of shamed her on some level into discarding this thing, which she was right, it wasn't hurting anybody. And I really wish I hadn't done that, and I wish I still had that vanilla bean. I wish I could show and tell it, and now I can only tell it. But at least you all know what a vanilla bean in a test tube looks like, so you can envision as if I had it here. I think that's it for show and tell tonight. The email lists are going around. If you haven't already signed them, feel free to sign up for the show and tell email list and or the cabinet email list. Thank you so much to Sina and Jaffe and Cabinet for hosting us here. And will the bar be open for a little bit longer?
Yes, the bar will be open. The next show and tell list, we have a date for it.
I believe we said April. It's the third Wednesday. It's a Wednesday is what we settled on. Yeah, it'll be on the cabinet website. It'll be, I'll send out an email. It's bad that I'm late. Is that right? Is that the Wednesday? Okay.
I'm sorry, the 18th.
18th. That sounds right. Okay, so the next show and tell will be Wednesday, April 18th at 7:30, and the format will be very similar to this. And I hope I'll see lots of you here. And bring your friends.
Thank you to everybody who stepped up, and also thank you to Paul.
Yes. Oh. Thank all of you.